Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel in the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. We interview philosophers about their new books, covering a wide range of areas, including ethics, metaphysics, philosophy of mind, political philosophy, aesthetics, and many more. Today's interview is with Tad Sawitzky, Associate Professor of Philosophy and Co-Director of the Mind-Brain Evolution Cluster at the George Washington University. We'll be talking about his new book, Mind Shaping, A New Framework for Understanding Human Social Cognition, which is just out from the MIT Press. Social cognition involves a small bundle of cognitive capacities and behaviors that enable us to communicate and get along with each other, a bundle that we have and even our closest primate cousins don't, at least not to the same level of sophistication. Pervasive collaboration, language, mind reading, and what Sawitzky calls mind shaping, which in turn includes our capacities and dispositions to imitate, to be natural learners, and to conform to and enforce social norms. Most researchers hold that mind reading, our theory of mind, is the linchpin of the rest. Our ability to ascribe one another mental states with propositional content is necessary for sophisticated language use and for mind shaping. Sawitzky argues, in contrast, that what's fundamental in social cognition is the mind shaping capacity, that this ability to homogenize our minds, as he puts it, makes sophisticated mind reading and language possible. On his view, for example, language didn't evolve so that we could express thought. It evolved so that we could express our commitment to cooperative behavior. Sawitzky's innovative approach centers on reinterpreting and extending Daniel Dennett's intentional stance so that it takes on a role in the cognitive development of the species and in individuals' development of their other social cognitive capacities. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Tad.
Hello.
Hi, welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for having me.
I'm very excited to be talking about your new book, Mind Shaping, A New Framework for Understanding Human Social Cognition, which is just out from MIT. Before we get into the details of the interview, I always like to start with a little bit of background about you and about the project. So how did you come to philosophy in general, and how did you get interested in the topic of the book and come to write the book?
Well, I was probably interested in philosophy since I was a teenager, but didn't quite know what it was till I went to college. And then when I took a few classes, I decided to major in it. I had a professor there who was kind of a mentor to me, and got me interested in philosophy of cognitive science specifically. We even published a paper together way back then. And afterwards, I got a bunch of opportunities to do graduate work, first at the University of Sussex in their master's program in COGS. I wanted to go there because Andy Clark was there. And then when I got there, Andy Clark was moving to Washington University to the new PNP program. So I just kind of followed him to St. Louis and enrolled in the PNP program. So I had been interested in issues having to do with the mind and empirical studies of the mind and their philosophical implications and assumptions for a very long time. I think I was always very interested in sort of the problem that most motivated me was always how our everyday understanding of the mind and human beings relates to the scientific understanding. So issues like eliminativism and so forth. I'm sort of a big fan of Daniel Dennett's work and his attempts to reconcile our common sense self-interpretation with what science is telling us about brains and such. So that was sort of always my motivating factor. And from early on, back in my days in my master's degree at Sussex, it had occurred to me that maybe the way people conceptualized this problem was wrong, that our our self-interpretations are not really in the same business as our scientific frameworks for understanding human behavior and the brain. And the thought I had was that maybe our self-interpretations play more of a regulative role. So I've had this thought for a week, and now I, it kind of came to fruition in recent years. I wrote this paper called Mind Shaping in 2008. It was published in Philosophical Explorations, and I decided to sort of expand on the idea over the following 5 years, and the book is a product of that.
So you begin the book with a methodological point, right? And it's basically a defense of evolutionary psychology, which has gotten a kind of a bad rap as a bunch of just-so stories about how we came to be where we are. And you defend it. I mean, you think it's not that your alternative version, or any version actually, of evolutionary psychological story of how our social cognitive capacities evolved. It's not just a matter of just-so stories. So on your view, I mean, how do you defend evolutionary psychology and the approach that you take to explaining social cognition?
Yeah, well, I think it's highly problematic. I agree with critics. I just don't think we have a choice or an option when it comes to thinking about the mind. We have no choice but to think about how it evolved. And the reason is that I think that in cognitive science, you have to begin with, or at least be guided by, functional hypotheses about what parts of the brain are for, what they're doing for us. This is an assumption shared by evolutionary psychologists as well as people who are critical of evolutionary psychology. All the way back to David Marr's book, Vision, he outlined a kind of three-step methodology in explaining a cognitive capacity. And the first step is getting clear on what the capacity is doing, what it's there for. And I think if you don't look for a biological approach to that question, you're stuck with just intuitions or a priori assumptions. So my thinking here is inspired by an old paper by Patricia Churchland, V.S. Ramachandran, and Terry Sanowski called A Critique of Pure Vision, where they're actually criticizing Marr's approach. And they argue that the problem with Marr's approach is he takes this a priori stance towards figuring out what vision is for. Mm-hmm. And if we think about it a priori, we think, well, vision is for getting around the environment, getting information through visual properties of the environment, and it requires us to construct a detailed three-dimensional model of the environment. That's the goal of vision. And what Churchland, Sanowski, and Ramachandran argue is, if you take an evolutionary perspective, you're not necessarily wedded to that. You can, if you see vision as the product of a long process of evolution, you could see that primitive vision might have not required a detailed three-dimensional model of the environment, and that the sort of three-dimensional model was sort of a late add-on, which wasn't essential to guiding action. And I want to do something similar for social cognition. I think if we look at social cognition a priori, it seems like we can't do anything adaptive socially. We can't cooperate. We can't communicate unless we first get accurate pictures of each other's minds, unless we can first mind read accurately. And so a priori, it seems like mind reading will be the most important component of human social cognition. And so propositional attitude attribution in particular will be sort of fundamental. But I think if we take an evolutionary perspective, as with, the Ramachandran, Sanowski, Churchland argument, we can look at social cognition in a completely different way and see that much more primitive mechanisms may have played a more important role in evolution, and hence may actually still play a more important role. So that's the motivation. I want our speculation about what social cognition is for to be constrained by empirical matters, like what it evolved to do. But I grant it's really difficult to get feasible empirical constraints here. I mean, we don't have time machines. We can't really go back in time. And, you know, our speculations there will always be problematic due to the dearth of evidence, of empirical evidence. But I still think they're better. There's more constraints there than just a priori speculation. And some I go in the book through some kinds of evidence that I think are relevant. For example, we have fossils that tell us roughly when our skulls started expanding at a rapid rate. There's evidence that raises all sorts of interesting issues, like how do you birth a child if you're a biped and you have a narrow pelvis? How do you birth a child with a huge head? Well, one thing you do is you birth children, which is what humans do, with partially collapsed skulls and undeveloped brains. And what can we infer from that? Well, that a lot more brain development happens after birth in humans and in our ancestors than does in other species. And I think this has some really important implications for social cognition. So that's an example of how a sort of rigorous empirical data could constrain our hypotheses about what social cognition is for. Basically, the framework I take is there's got to be some fact of the matter as to why the distinctively human sociocognitive capacities, mind reading and such, caught on at a particular point in history and not earlier. And there's got to be a fact of the matter as to why they've been maintained in human populations and how they've been maintained up to the present day in human populations. Now, these are facts about biology, and of course it's hard to ascertain what these facts are, given that the evidence is noisy, but the facts are there, and they play an important role, I think, in constraining other projects in cognitive science and understanding what parts of the brain are for example. And so it's worth finding what evidence there is to try and establish these facts.
So when you talk about social cognition, before we get into your particular particular hierarchy or view of how it evolved, maybe you could say a word about what social cognition is generally thought to consist of, you know, what the elements of this, what you call the social cognitive syndrome are.
Yeah, well, the sociocognitive syndrome involves more than just social cognition. It involves various social capacities. So what I mean by the human sociocognitive syndrome is those social capacities which appear to distinguish our species from others. So other species have plenty of sociocognitive capacities, and we share plenty of sociocognitive capacities with other species. But I think there are four which there's a lot of consensus, are pretty distinctive of human beings. So one is, and the one that has traditionally been taken to be the central one, is sophisticated mind reading. And what I mean by this is the attribution of full-blown propositional attitudes, like belief and desire, as such. I think we share a lot of more rudimentary forms of attribution, psychological attributions, with other species. Like, we can track behavioral patterns and so forth, maybe keep track of emotions. But attributing beliefs and desires, especially beliefs, there's a lot of consensus that only humans do that. Another feature which is distinctive of human social capacities, is what I call sophisticated mind shaping. And there are a lot of examples, but we're much better at imitating the fine-grained behavioral properties of our conspecifics than even the great apes are, even chimpanzees or orangutans. Another thing we're good at is we're better at pedagogy, at teaching offspring things. Another thing we are good at is norm enforcement. So we're good at making each other match certain regulative or normative ideals. And of course, the most sophisticated forms of mind shaping involve kind of abstract models that we have in myths and other language-based forms, like the law, where we try to get people to match certain abstract models. So that's something also that's distinctive of human social capacities. Another thing that is distinctive is cooperation. There are rudimentary forms of cooperation in other primate species, but nothing approaches the sort of pervasiveness and importance of cooperation that we see in human populations. And finally, there's human language, which on a number of levels is very different from animal communication. It's structurally very complex. It's got recursive structure, and it's semantically very flexible. We could use language to talk about anything, which is not the case for human-animal communication systems. So the human sociocognitive syndrome consists of these four distinctive capacities: sophisticated mind reading, sophisticated mind shaping, distinctively human language, and the pervasive cooperation that you see in human populations. And what I want to say is that I want to investigate how these four capacities are related to each other, both now and in evolution. And I think the standard view is that sophisticated mind reading was the most important step, that before we could attribute full-blown propositional attitudes to each other, beliefs and desires, we couldn't really engage in sophisticated mind shaping, pervasive cooperation, and sophisticated language. And I want to sort of turn that on its head. I want to say that actually sophisticated mind shaping was really much more important in that, and we couldn't really attribute propositional attitudes until we already had sophisticated mind shaping, widespread cooperation, and sophisticated language on the scene.
So could you maybe go a bit into what mind shaping is? I mean, that's not a phrase that is already kind of in widespread use. So, and in your second chapter, you go into details what you mean by that. So maybe you could explain, you describe it as mind shaping as getting a target mind to match a model. So maybe you could explain to us what you mean by mind shaping.
Yeah, I use the term because I want to contrast it with mind reading. So that's sort of a term of art that's been around for several decades now. Stitch and Nichols and Stitch have that book, Mind Reading, and I wanted to say, actually, social cognition is more about mind shaping than mind reading. So that's part of the reason I chose the term. And the term I get from a paper by Matteo Mamelli from 2001 in Biology and Philosophy, where he argued that a lot of our interpretive practices, attribution of beliefs and desires, actually function to shape minds more than to read them. So we have these expectations about how people will act based on our attributions of mental states, and then people kind of work to confirm those expectations. So these expectations shape their behavior as much as help us predict it. So that's what I was inspired by. But I think that there's a variety of practices and mechanisms, all that count as mind shaping. And what they all have in common is there is some mind being shaped. That's the target. And it's being shaped to resemble or somehow match a model. And a model can be the behavior of an actual individual. So in imitation, you're trying to imitate someone. The model is the behavior of the person you're trying to imitate. But sometimes the model, especially in sophisticated forms of distinctively human mind shaping, the model is something more abstract. So, for example, it's a fictional character, some kind of mythical or religious figure. We read stories about them and we try to emulate them. So, you know, the famous slogan that you see on bumpers, what would Jesus do there? So there you're imitating not an actual concrete individual that you have experience of, but an abstract model. So all of these are cases of mind shaping, and there are a variety of mechanisms that that perform this basic function of trying to get a target mind to resemble in certain respects some kind of model. Now, what matters is that the behavior is matched, but you can't really get a match in behavioral dispositions unless you've shaped the mind in some way. Now, these mechanisms needn't involve the conceptualization of a mind. That's very important. So you can have a mechanism which isn't kind of thinking of itself as shaping a mind. It doesn't have any representations of minds as such. But as a matter of fact, as an effect of its activity, a mind gets shaped because what the mechanism is aiming to do is to match a behavioral disposition to the behavior of some model. And the only way that could be done is by, as a matter of fact, shaping the mind of the target such that it's disposed to issue in that kind of behavior.
Although we're doing this without actually trying to, the goal is not to shape the mind, the goal is to shape the behavior or the behavioral dispositions.
Right, but I don't think you can shape a behavioral disposition without shaping a mind. The problem here, I think, is when your goals here are understood teleofunctionally, mm-hmm. like a la Millikan, say, and so they're non-intentional with an S. So you can shape a mind without thinking of yourself as shaping a mind, right? You can have the function of shaping a mind if, you know, by shaping a behavioral disposition, you also happen to be shaping a mind. What matters is what the thing was selected for in evolution. So I guess what mattered in evolution was that the behavior matched. But as a matter of fact, the only way in evolution you could have gotten the behavior to match is by actually shaping the mind, whether or not it was conceived of that way.
Okay, so you criticize, I mean, this is your main target is the idea that mind reading, as you put it, sophisticated mind reading is the linchpin. And you're replacing that with mind shaping as the linchpin. So what's the main problem as you see it with the mind reading first view?
Yeah. Well, again, what I mean by sophisticated mind reading is what's distinctive of human beings. And I think there I'm focused on the attribution of propositional attitudes as such, so beliefs and desires. I think, especially beliefs, I think that's something that we can do and other animals can't do. There's a lot of sociocognitive capacities that we use in everyday life without even thinking about it, which I think, say, chimpanzees also have. So that's not what I'm trying to explain. Now, the idea that we have to attribute beliefs and desires as such before we can do anything else, I think is problematic because of what people like Jose Luis Bermudez and Adam Morton have called the holism problem. So there's not a simple link between belief and behavior. When you believe X, it'll only yield a certain behavior if you also believe and desire a bunch of other things. And so it's hard to see how in dynamic, sort of evolutionary, plausible social contexts, attributing mental states that have such a tenuous connection to behavior could have had a predictive dividend. How could it have helped me predict behavior better than I could already predict behavior if attributing a belief doesn't directly lead to any particular behavior? Mm-hmm. So that's the general problem. And the idea I have is that it's only once you've got fairly sophisticated mind-shaping practices of the kind that you don't see in other animals, when people are shaped to have similar beliefs in similar contexts and to act in similar ways when they have similar beliefs, that attributing beliefs could actually help. Before such mechanisms, before such shaping mechanisms, there's really no reason to believe that people would be sufficiently alike to be predictable given a certain belief attribution. So that's the basic argument.
And you also have a basic criticism of the idea that language also requires this sophisticated mind reading first view. I mean, that's a pretty well entrenched idea, right? That there's a particular Gricean picture of language in which it involves attributing all kinds of communicative intentions to each other. And of course, if mind reading comes after the mind shaping, then language is also going to be after. And of course, the Gricean picture is just going to kind of fall apart. So could you explain a bit your discomfort with that picture of the relation between, well, those three elements, I suppose, language, mind reading and then your alternative mind shaping first.
Yeah, this was probably the most challenging and part of the book for me, because you're right, it's a very entrenched view. There's sort of two reasons why I targeted the Grayson picture as it's classically understood. One was a sort of reason internal to my project. I wanted to argue that you needed language on the scene before you could have sophisticated mind reading, before you get a propositional attitude attribution. And a lot of people have made this claim. Andy Clark, my advisor, makes a claim along these lines in Being There. More recently, Daniel Couto in his book, Folk Psychological Narratives, defends a claim along these lines. So there are some precedents where people are challenging the Gricean picture. And for me, I think ultimately you don't really need propositional attitude attribution as such to predict behavior. There are all sorts of lower level mechanisms which allow us to do that. And so the question becomes, why do we need propositional attitude attribution? And I'm going to argue it's only once you have language in which you make commitments to certain statements, to certain claims, that you need a practice of propositional attitude attribution. But that requires, that means that language has to be on the scene prior to full-blown propositional attitude attribution. So that's the motivation from within my project. The external motivation is just that I think it's highly implausible that, say, in conversation, like the conversation we're having right now, we're interpreting each other, and it just seems highly implausible that this seamless dynamic give and take that we're having involves theoretical leaps and hypotheses about the causes, the mental causes of what you're saying, which is one way of reading the Gricean picture. I just think that language use and conversation is just too dynamic, too seamless, and too reliable. Happens too quickly for the interpretive component of it to be conceptualized as the attribution of hidden mental causes with tenuous connections to behavior and content, which is what propositional attitudes are. So what I argue is, now I think the reason Griceanism has been so plausible is because people aren't precise enough about what they mean by propositional attitude attribution. Ian Apperly makes this point in his wonderful recent book called Mind Readers, 2011, where he kind of distinguishes between the normative account of propositional attitude attribution, which is what you know, a philosopher might say is involved in attributing a belief. And this requires some pretty sophisticated cognitive abilities. You have to, a belief is something which is an unobservable state. Because of holism, it has this tenuous connection to behavior. It's got to be an internal, unobservable cause that has propositional content. There has to be a mode of presentation so that two different individuals could represent the same state of affairs in different ways. So there's all these sophisticated abilities and knowledge you need to attribute a belief. And it's really a difficult, I mean, as a psychologist will acknowledge, it's really difficult based on the kind of fragmentary behavioral evidence that we have in everyday life when we're having a conversation to make these inferences to these hidden complex mental states. It seems really difficult to do that. So how do you explain the seamless dynamics of conversation? Well, in my view, a lot of people who attracted to Griceanism are actually, when they say we're attributing beliefs, are actually thinking of something much simpler. And what I'm thinking, what I like to call it, is I like to assimilate that to Dennett's notion of an intentional stance. But I think adopting the intentional stance towards a behavior, be it linguistic or non-linguistic, is a much more rudimentary capacity. You're not hypothesizing a hidden mental state. What you're doing is you're trying to rationalize the behavior. You're looking for an obvious goal that will make the behavior seem rational relative to the context that the behavior in which it's taking place. And I want to argue that that's much more computationally tractable. That's probably what's going on when we interpret each other in conversation, but that doesn't count as full-blown propositional attitude attribution. It's not an ability that's different in kind from what chimpanzees do. Chimpanzees can adopt more rudimentary versions of the intentional stance. What they can't do is posit hidden, causally potent mental states with problematic, tenuous connections to behavior and propositional content. And I don't think we need to do that when we're interpreting each other in conversation.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the intentional stance, because that does seem to play a very large role. I mean, sort of throughout the book, it seems, you know, driven by basically applying the intentional stance or an intentional stance-like capacity or framework, where otherwise we might posit something much more, as you put it, full-blown or sophisticated. And so maybe you could say something about how you understand the intentional stance and its role in your kind of overall picture. Because the intentional stance is, you know, from Dennett, and it's generally seen as, you know, ascribing beliefs and desires, but as you put it, and as I put it, you know, it's more like belief star or desire star. It's something that a lectern that is just there can have beliefs and desires in the sense of the intentional stance. So the intentional stance itself is a theoretical construct, plays an important role in your theory. It's supposed to be far more primitive, at least, you know, in theory, than the things it's supposed to explain. So maybe you could expand a bit more on how you take what you understand the intentional stance to be and its role in your overall theory.
Certainly, yes. I mean, it's very important, and, you know, Dennett's probably my favorite philosopher, so I'm very inspired by his work, and I think I see this book as very compatible with what he says, but it's also parts of it are incompatible, because he says many different things about the intentional stance, and sometimes he proposes it as an analysis of our full-blown concepts of belief and desire, and I think it isn't. That's not a good job for it. I think it's better understood as a characterization of what we do when we interpret each other in everyday life, but I don't think we attribute beliefs and desires for most everyday interactions, because it's just too difficult. I think the key distinction between attributing full-blown propositional attitudes and the intentional stance has to do with an appearance-reality distinction. So I think when it comes to attributing a propositional attitude, as philosophers have understood it, certainly, and a lot of psychologists, you have to think of what you're attributing as the mental reality behind the behavioral appearance. And what that means is you can imagine cases where you have two patterns of behavior which are very similar, even counterfactually similar, that are caused by radically different propositional attitudes. That's what an internal cause is. That's what the mental reality is supposed to be. It's not something that is easily read off of behavior. This is not what the intentional stance is. According to Dennett, if you make an attribution that rationalizes the behavior and enables you to predict the next step, that's all there is to the attribution. There is no deeper fact of the matter. So in a classic discussion, Dennett asks us to imagine an art critic, a famous art critic who has a son who decides to become an artist and becomes a mediocre artist. And the art critic is constantly sort of praising the art in public, saying how great it is. And Dennett says that behavior seems compatible with two different attributions. Either the art critic is so blinded by love for his son that he actually believes the son's art has value, or the art critic doesn't believe the son's art has value, but behaves as though he does out of sort of concern for his son. And Dennett says that we could look at the entire autobiography or the entire biography of this art critic from till he dies and find absolutely no evidence that goes one way or another. And he thinks that if that's the case, there is no deeper fact of the matter as to what the art critic really believed. Now, that's how the intentional stance works, but I don't think that's what our concepts of attributing propositional attitudes amount to. right? And so that's why I think the intentional stance is pitched at the level of behavior. Any attribution which makes sense of behavior and enables us to predict future behavior is equally good. So I think there is no distinction between the behavioral appearance and the mental reality. All that matters is whatever explains the behavioral appearance. So I don't actually think you need, at the level of the intentional stance, to posit internal, unobservable, causally potent mental states. In fact, Dennett says he doesn't think of the beliefs and desires as causally potent mental states. That's why I use belief star and desire star, as you say. He thinks of them as just these abstract posits which help us track behavioral patterns. And I think this maps very nicely onto a new paradigm in developmental psychology called the teleological stance by the Hungarian developmentalists Gyorgy Csibra and Gergely Csibra and Gyorgy Gergely. They argue that even very young infants assume that agents aim at a goal and pick the most efficient means from those available in the context to accomplish the goal. And I think that's a very rudimentary example of the intentional stance. You're not speculating about the causes of the behavior, the hidden, unobservable states that yield the behavior. You're just saying, look, this behavior can make sense. It's rational. It's an efficient behavior if we assume it's aiming at this end state given these constraints. So I think the teleological stance is sort of a rudimentary version of the intentional stance. There's evidence that chimpanzees employ a similar heuristic. And then I think this develops. So what happens in human development is infants assume that all behavior of other agents aims at a goal in the most efficient way given the constraints of the context. But then sometimes this assumption is confuted. So the agent appears to engage in a behavior which is inefficient. And then what that does is it drives the infant to notice other factors which might show the behavior to be efficient, even though at first it looked inefficient. So the infant might notice that the agent didn't notice something, wasn't looking at a relevant object in the environment. And so the infant learns, well, if you don't see the relevant object, you won't engage in what appears to be the most efficient behavior. Relative to what you've seen, your behavior will be efficient, but not relative to the actual facts. And so there you get a more sophisticated version of the intentional stance, but you're still not positing internal, opaque internal mental states. You're simply looking for factors that are available in the environment that can explain why the behavior really is efficient, even though at first it didn't appear to be efficient. And I think this is what the intentional stance is. And you can imagine infants bootstrapping to ever more sophisticated understandings of agency based entirely on this heuristic that all agent behavior is always the most efficient behavior for accomplishing some goal. And if it looks inefficient, look for some mitigating factor. So that's the intentional stance.
There were a lot of questions that you know would naturally be raised in all of what you've just said. But let me just pick up on this last issue, because you seem to, you know, what's in the back of your mind and mind obviously is a lot of this literature on the false belief task, right? Which is usually interpreted as when do infants or very young children begin to ascribe full-blown propositional attitudes? And it's, you know, latest it's been pushed back to like 6 months where, you know, based on looking time behavior, right? I mean, human infants are able to or have some sort of a theory of mind. And you're of course, just saying, wait. No, that's just, it's just reading behavior a la intentional stance. But at the same time, they are interpreting what's being done in terms of goals. that seems to be a fairly sophisticated capacity right there. So I'm just wondering if you could say more about, you know, just how primitive the intentional stance is within the picture of the role that you want to give it within your overall theory.
Yeah. I don't doubt that it's a sophisticated capacity, but remember, I try to stress this throughout the book, that what I'm interested in is explaining distinctively human sociocognitive capacities. And I think the attribution of goals is not distinctively human. There are a lot of species, not even just primate species. I mean, there are bird species that seems to be good evidence they attribute goals. I think for me, and I think for the intentional stance, to attribute a goal is not necessarily to attribute representation of a goal. So when you attribute a goal to something, it doesn't mean you're thinking of the thing as having a representation of that goal somewhere in its head that's causing the behavior, the goal-directed behavior.
Mm-hmm.
The things having the goal can just be a primitive idea you have. It's a primitive relational thing. That the goal is that state, which it'll arrive at in the future. So you envision a future state, and that thing is related somehow to that state. And that's all you think. You don't think that there has to be some kind of state within the agent which is representing that goal. So that's the idea. And I think it's there in the intentional stance, because after all, Dennett says that things like the process of natural selection, plants, even lightning, are often interpreted from the intentional stance to have goals. And I don't think when we do that, I agree with him that we do that often, but I don't think when we do that, we think of the lightning or natural selection as having a representation of the goal. It just has the goal simpliciter. Why not? And then when in human infants, so with the false belief tasks, the looking time, nonverbal false belief tasks, I think that is more sophisticated than just attributing goals, because there's a sensitivity to the information. But again, I think you could understand that as information access, where information access is a primitive relationship between the agent you're interpreting and some kind of factor in the environment. And there's no assumption that there's a state within the agent which represents the information. There's just this primitive assumption that if you do not have access to information A, you won't act efficiently towards goal G, in the way I would say, because you don't have access to that information. But that doesn't imply that there's a state in your head which represents that information mm-hmm. and causes your actions, right? So that's the sense in which I think the intentional stance is entirely at the level of behavioral appearances and more primitive than full-blown theory of mind, which requires the attribution of internal states that represent goals and information. And as I say in one of my chapters, I think this whole bit of language that we've gotten to use to describe infant sociocognitive competence, this is all derived from, you know, Sellers's Myth of Jones and Gopnik and people who really took seriously the idea that sociocognitive competence is the application of a theory, much like what scientists do. I think that's an unfortunate set of metaphors that we're using, because if you think of it as a theory of mind, you're thinking that the infant has a concept of a mind. And what is a mind except for some kind of enduring causal nexus that's unobservable, that goes into these states that are unobservable and that cause certain behaviors? And I just think it's ridiculous to think that infants have those concepts. You know, 6-month-old infants have those concepts. And I think a lot of people who characterize what those infants are doing as theory of mind, they would agree that that's ridiculous. So what I'm just warning people about is, you know, be careful in how you describe these capacities. There's no doubt that these are sophisticated capacities. A lot of them are unique to humans, but do they really involve anything that's like theorizing about hidden causes and a hidden causal nexus that's responsible for behavior? I don't think so. I think you can make sense of it as tracking relationships to goals and relationships to available information. And that seems to be a much less, commits you to a lot less crazy attributions to, say, a 6-month-old infant.
Okay, so you, I take it then that I mean, Dennett is often, or sometimes at least, read as an anti-realist or instrumentalist. Whether that's right or not, I'm not saying, but just the idea that the intentional stance, you know, we can attribute these beliefs and desires, and we just do, it's basically behavior tracking. And then that's it. You know, there's no fact of the matter is often interpreted as, well, you know, that's it. It's just what we can know, and there is no sort of there is no determinate mental state, you know, hidden, you know, causally efficacious state inside the head of the, you know, the father of the artist, for example. You seem to be departing from that particular interpretation of Dennett. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, it's interesting that you asked this. It's a great question. I think the reason Dennett is committed to that, and the reason is that he sees the intentional stance as an analysis of our full-blown concepts of belief and desire,
yeah,
and also as a methodology for doing cognitive science when we're trying to interpret things. So that's what leads to the anti-realism, because if that's all that beliefs and desires are, then, you know, there's no fact of the matter as to ultimately regarding which beliefs and desires we have. My innovation in this book is to kind of bracket that whole debate and give people like Fodor their views, accept their views when it comes to the analysis of what beliefs and desires, what the concepts of beliefs and desires are, and even to scientific methodology. So just say, maybe they're right. Cognitive science aims to uncover the facts of the matter regarding the causally efficacious mental states that yield behavior. Mm-hmm. And those causally efficacious mental states will be a lot like what the folk take beliefs and desires to be, internal representational states that are have, you know, opacity and complex causal relationships to behavior. I'll grant the anti-Dennettians that. But that still leaves open the possibility that infants are Dennettians. So rather than theorists, rather than Fodorians, rather than full-blown, you know, speculators about the causal etiology of behavior, they are Dennettians. So maybe Dennett's wrong about our mature concepts and about what science is doing, cognitive science is doing, but he still might be right about what infants are doing, right? And so the innovation here is that what Ian Apperly calls system one mind reading, the primitive, automatic, largely unconscious kind of mind reading that you see in looking tasks and that we likely share to some extent with chimpanzees, that at that point we're not being theorists, we're not making a behavioral appearance mental reality distinction, we're not postulating internal states with causal control over behavior. We're just being Dennettians. We're trying to compress behavior into these abstract categories, which I call goal and information access rather than belief and desire, to distinguish it from these more full-blown concepts. So I mean my view to be compatible with the more sort of Fodorian understanding of what beliefs and desires are and of what cognitive science aims to do. Even though I'm not committed either way there. Dennett might be right about that as well, or Fodor might be right. I don't really care about that. So my view is actually compatible with there being determinate facts, mm-hmm, about what your beliefs and desires are. They're just not the kind of facts that we find through quotidian interpretation, everyday common sense interpretation. They're the kind of facts that you need to do cognitive science to find out about. But in everyday life, we don't need to settle the issue of what you really believe, what you really desire. All we need to settle is what the best way of interpreting the pattern of behavior is, right? So that's my point. My point is that we can be Dennettians about what infants can do and what adults do in their unreflective, everyday, seamless interactions, even if we're neutral about Dennett, whether Dennett's right about our mature concepts of belief and desire and about what cognitive science is doing.
Okay, that was very helpful to me. So let's look at how you look at, for example, language then. So the standard view, you know, language evolved to express thought, something like that. And your view is that language evolved, and I'm kind of, you know, shortening, paraphrasing, oversimplifying, language evolved to enable us to commit to behavior consistent with the claims we make. And this requires a bit of unpacking. So because you bring in people like Robert Brandom and others. So could you explain on your view, now that we've sort of taken on board your reversal of the relationship between language and mind shaping and mind reading, what did we evolve language for on your view? Could you explain that?
Yeah. So again, there are different components of language, some of which are more puzzling than others. So I'm kind of taking on board, I think, a common view that goes all the way back to Derek Bickerton's ideas on this from the 90s, where we have this, it starts with a kind of proto-language, which is agrammatical. There are terms for objects and terms for properties of those objects. And they can only be concatenated in like two word utterances. The order doesn't matter. So there's no grammar. There's no structural complexity. And this can be seen already in some non-human primate species. You know, any signal which draws attention to an object and maybe says something about it, like, you know, you can think of the vervets warning each other about various kinds of predators as a rudimentary version of this. The real puzzle about human language is how it got to have the structural grammatic complexity that it has, and then eventually the sorts of thoughts that can be expressed with a system of that structural grammatic complexity. Because if you don't have structural grammatic complexity, if you don't have recursion, you can't really think about things which are spatial, temporally displaced, things that you've never seen, and that's really the semantic power of language. So the real question about language is, the real puzzle is how it became structurally, grammatically complex. Now, the received view of this sort of Pinker-Bloom hypothesis, is that we already had structurally complex thought. We had a recursive thought that enabled us to think about spatio-temporally displaced objects, and so it would have been really adaptive to be able to share such thoughts, so we needed a language that was also structurally complex. And I think that's what's implausible. I think there's very little evidence that animals without language have these kinds of thoughts that are just, you know, waiting to be expressed. And also there's a lot of evidence that a lot of our practical day-to-day coordination can be accomplished with much simpler communication systems. There's something called the basic variety studied by linguists Klein and Perdue, which they look at sort of merchant marines from different countries and how they interact in ports and the kind of really rudimentary languages they use and how successful they are at coordinating without a structurally complex language. So it's always been a puzzle about human language why it got so structurally complex. Why did we need a system capable of expressing things as abstract as, you know, the origin of the universe or various myths or other things? So this is Chomsky's puzzle about the evolution of language, really. So my option to this is, I noticed something. This is a suggestion of Darwin's. William Tecumseh Fitch picks up on it. There's evidence that bird signaling systems, bird song, can reach a lot of structural complexity, even though semantically they're very rudimentary. They're always conveying the same message, which, you know, on a sexual selection theory is always basically mate with me. But there was pressure to make it more complex, the similar kind of pressure that gave us the peacock's feathers, that birds capable of more complex song were just better mates or something like that. Well, I Tecumseh Fitch thinks there's something to this in his recent book, William Tecumseh Fitch, Language Evolution, and it's picking up on a suggestion of Darwin's that language is descended from a proto-linguistic kind of song-like ability. But I think there's no evidence that the role this played in prehistoric human populations was sexual. For one thing, there's no sexual dimorphism as there is in bird species. But typically, it's the males that are capable of these songs, not in the human species. There's no dimorphism there. also, it's not linked to puberty. Human children are capable of complex language far before puberty. So it's probably not sexual. And my hypothesis is that it was had to do with cooperation, that to signal your abilities to cooperate and your reliability as a cooperative partner, perhaps you had to engage in some kind of perhaps ritualized communicative behavior, including dance and song. And that was what drove the evolution of our capacity for complex communication. That, you know, there would be this competition between, you know, the better you were at these complex rituals, the more reliable you were deemed, the better a cooperative partner you were deemed. And that was the pressure that led in this kind of arms race to increasing capacities for complex communication. So right from the start, complex language was used to signal commitment to cooperative behaviors, right? And that's the idea I have. So once that's on the scene, once you have language as this signaling device, this complex signaling device, I think after that happens, you have all sorts of pressure, you know, to live up to your commitments, those commitments you signaled. And if you don't live up to them, you have to somehow, you know, excuse your behavior. And that's really where propositional attitude attribution comes in.
So it's in providing excuses or reasons for exactly what we do.
Justifying your behavior, yes. And this, you know, here I'm picking up on a whole other literature that begins with Jerome Bruner's book, Acts of Meaning, where he sort of notices that a lot of propositional attitude attributions in everyday life, in such sophisticated adult propositional attitude attributions, involve giving a story mm-hmm. that rationalizes or justifies an apparent deviation from a community norm in terms of beliefs and desires that make it seem rational. And there's some sort of empirical evidence for this. I mentioned in my final chapter this really fascinating study by Bertram Mall and co-authors from 2007, where they showed that adults, when they attribute beliefs and desires as opposed to external causes for someone's behavior, they will tend to, when they explain their own behavior, they'll attribute beliefs and desires, propositional attitudes. When they explain someone else's behavior, they'll attribute things like, oh, they had a bad childhood, or, you know, they're just lazy, character traits that don't rationalize the behavior. And it turns out that it really doesn't matter how well you know the other person. Even if it's a parent or someone who's intimate, you will still more likely to attribute to them this external factor rather than a rationalizing, justifying propositional attitude. But when you're asked to make someone else's behavior look good, suddenly you attribute propositional attitudes towards them at the same rate as you would towards yourself. So it seems that evidence seems to show that what we're really doing when we're attributing propositional attitudes is trying to make our behavior look good. Now, giving an excuse is just one example. They have a more general term for this called impression management. Mm. Sometimes the attribution of propositional attitudes might actually be, rather than exculpatory, it might be inculpatory. So if someone engages in a behavior that you think is terrible, you'll be more likely to say they did it intentionally, that they wanted to do it. And this, I think, ties in with Joshua Nobe's
right.
work, with the you know, the vignettes where when the CEO does something good to the environment by accident, we'll say it was unintentional. If they do something bad to the environment by accident, we'll say it was intentional. Again, I think we're using propositional attitudes there for a kind of normative, mind-shapey sort of function. We're trying to discourage a kind of behavior by saying it was intentional. So sometimes we'll use propositional attitudes to rescue our status when we're sort of at risk of having our mind shaped basically by normative sanction. Other times we'll use propositional attitude attribution to help shape minds to respect certain norms. But it's not principally to predict what people will do, to speculate about their internal causes. It's rather to sort of situate them in a space, a justificatory space, so to speak. So that's the burden of the final chapter of the book, is to argue for that.
Okay, well, we are just about out of time. So that's probably a good place to kind of ask Well, I had wanted to ask about how coordination emerges on your view to kind of wrap everything up. So maybe you could say very briefly, on your view, how human cooperation evolved.
Yeah, well, cooperation and coordination are related, but they're not exactly the same issue. So one issue, cooperation is how are we motivated to help each other out when the incentives seem to go against it, a prisoner's dilemma situation. Coordination issue is even when the incentives are for cooperation, there are a number of options, and we don't know what option the other person will pick. So how do we know which options we'll pick? So the classic example is an interrupted telephone conversation. We're both motivated to get back on the line, but if we call at the same time, the line will be busy. If neither of us calls, we won't get reconnected. So how do we coordinate that situation? Now, of course, mature populations do this with language, but the problem has always been that language itself presupposes a solution to these coordination problems, that we use words in similar ways. So how can this be done? And this appears to be a job for mind reading, but I argue in chapter 4 of my book that mind reading really won't solve the problem, because, when we read each other's minds, all we learn is that the other person is trying to figure out what we're thinking, and you get caught in this kind of endless loop. So the idea is that coordination solved because there's this idea from the economist Michael Bacharach, wrote this book called Beyond Individual Choice about 10 years ago. Actually, it was published posthumously and edited by some colleagues of his because he died while it was being written. But his idea is that a lot of these coordination problems require us to think of them not as a problem facing two people trying to coordinate, but rather as a problem facing a plural subject. So, for example, there's a classic game is called high-low. If we both pick high, we get the best reward. If we both pick low, we get a lower reward. If we pick the opposite, you pick high and I pick low, we get no reward. Well, how do I know what you're going to pick? If I see it as me trying to guess what you're going to do, all I'm going to know is that you're trying to guess what I'm going to do, and we never get to a resolution. But for humans, this is a fairly trivial game. They both always pick high. How do they know that? Bacharach thinks is they think as a team rather than as two individuals. So we think, what would be the best for us what pair of selections would be best for us? And obviously it's high-high. High-high gives the best overall distribution of goals. So if we think of problems as facing an us, what Bacharach calls a we construal, a first-person plural construal, this can solve a lot of coordination problems. So the question is, how do we conceive of problems as facing us rather than as a problem facing two individuals? And my idea is that it's through practices of mind shaping that we are educated to think of problems that way. And so you don't have to go around wondering whether a person you meet will think of the problem as a problem facing an us, because as a matter of fact, most of us are raised to think that way about problems. And so that's why mind shaping plays this really important role in coordination. There's also a story to tell about why it plays an important role in incentivizing cooperation. But I'm not going to get into it because we're low on time. But that's really the burden of chapter 4 in the book.
Okay, so we are out of time now, but I would like to slip in one last question. Where are you going from here? Are you working on a follow-up book or on different projects entirely?
I'm not really on a follow-up book, but I am trying to spin off some ideas from this book into shorter projects. The stuff I just said about the intentional stance and how it can be treated as a model for what we do when we're unreflectively predicting each other's behavior, even if it's not accurate as an analysis of full-blown belief desire. Mm-hmm. That's a paper I'm working on now for a Festschrift for Daniel Dennett that's being edited by Bryce Huebner. I want to work the idea I have in the final chapter about sort of the evolutionary roots of full-blown propositional attitude attribution being impression management rather than theoretical explanation or prediction. Mm-hmm. I want to work that into a sort of reinterpretation of Sellers' myth of Jones. I want to argue Jones was not a theoretical scientist. He was more like an advocate for people.
coming up with excuses for apparently deviant behavior. So I've given that talk at a few places. And I'm also working on a paper that talks a little bit about self-interpretation. If we accept the idea that a lot of the categories we use to interpret ourselves are, strictly speaking, inaccurate categories, they don't really describe what's going on in the brain, why might some self-interpretations be better than others? And I want to say the relevant norm here isn't truth. We're not trying to track a fact about how our brain works. The relevant norm is something like, it's kind of like a program on a computer. When you try to install a program on a computer, the program isn't there to describe what's going on in the computer. The program is something that you want the computer to do, and it's a good program if it gets the computer to do what you want in an efficient way. And so my idea is that our self-interpretations are kind of like that. They don't aim to describe what's happening in the brain. They're kind of aspirational. They're programs that we ought to want to run, so to speak. So that's the kind of third project I'm working on now.
Great. Well, thank you very much for a wonderful conversation.
And thank you. I've really enjoyed myself, and thanks for this opportunity.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to my interview with Tad Zawitzki, Associate Professor of Philosophy and Co-Director of the Mind-Brain Evolution Cluster at the George Washington University. We've been talking about his new book, Mind Shaping, A New Framework for Understanding Human Social Cognition, which is just out from the MIT Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.